From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, is it constitutional to sentence juveniles to life in prison without parole?
What would I want to happen for my surviving son? If this happened to him, if he took a life, would I want to see him spend the rest of his life in prison? And the answer was no.
The very short history of Hollywood targeting preteens at the box office. Then, the archaeology of artifacts left in the desert by undocumented migrants.
Matches from Chiapas, some cortisone cream, some cigarettes. There are two black water bottles under that tree.
We travel to New York City for a tour of the former hotspots on the Lower East Side. And finally, new music by Melanie Fiona. That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. The Supreme Court this week heard arguments about the fate of 2,500 offenders who were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole when they were teenagers. 79 of them were 13 or 14 years old when they committed their crimes. Many prosecutors and family members of victims spoke out about the need to keep the sentences in place. But in a small building cafeteria, just a few blocks from the Supreme Court, a different group of family members quietly came together. Half of them were families of teenagers who committed horrible crimes.
My name is Grace Warren. I'm from Illinois, and I have a son that's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
Hi, I'm Essie. My oldest son is serving juvenile life without
parole. Hi, my name is Deborah Buchanan, and my husband is serving life without parole.
And then there was the other half, family members of the teenagers' victims.
Hi, my name is Bill Pelkey. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. My grandmother was murdered by four teenage girls.
I'm Linda White.
My 26-year-old daughter, Kathy, was killed by a juvenile.
My name is Angel Cradle. My son was killed less than 5 years ago.
My name is Akilah Sherrells. My 19-year-old son, Terrell, was murdered.
And I am here to support this campaign.
People can change. I do believe they deserve a second chance.
And I'm here to support Citizen for Second Chance.
I believe that every child has a second chance.
This is not a group you often hear about. Victims' families who want the teenage perpetrators to get an opportunity for parole, who want to see sentences of life in prison for teens overturned. Many say they have often been unwilling to talk about the issue because they have been accused of not missing their loved ones enough. But on this day, in this room, there was enough sorrow to fill an afternoon. There was also enough forgiveness. That's our cover story today. Families devastated by the actions of teenagers who want those teens to one day get a chance to make amends. People like Mary Johnson.
I don't remember going down 8 flights on the elevator. I don't remember the short walk to the car. I don't even remember the short ride to my sister's home.
19 years ago, Johnson was at work in Minnesota when her sister-in-law called to tell her her 20-year-old son, Loramian, was dead. He had been shot to death. There was a fight at a party and a gun.
It was 2 or 3 days after Loramian was murdered. I got a call from the detectives. And he told me he had picked up a 16-year-old boy.
The boy's name was O'Shea Israel.
He was an animal. I wanted him charged as an adult, first-degree murder, in prison for the rest of his life.
Then you went through the court process, and you were in the courtroom, I'm sure, when he was sentenced.
Yep, I was there every time there was something going on because, I mean, I hated O'Shea.
Sitting here, off to the side of the rest of the group, Mary Johnson smiles. She looks directly across the table at O'Shea Israel.
O'Shea, did you kill Loramian?
Yes, I did. I was 16. He was 20.
O'Shea Israel was initially facing life in prison without parole, but the judge lessened the charge and sentenced Israel to 25 years, most of which he served. He got a few years off for good behavior. It was a long time since that night at the party.
Neither one of us wanted to back down, and me just being foolish enough to think that I held the most power and because I had a gun. He and I probably could have been the best of friends had we just taken the time to communicate.
At 16, though, Israel says none of it was really registering.
All I can do was kind of shut down and numb myself to it. It wasn't until years later that I started to make that connection with, like, wow, you know, I really did do this. I really am responsible for someone losing their life.
Johnson and Israel, and everyone else in this room, came together this week at the urging of a nonprofit group called the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. But how O'Shea Israel and Mary Johnson ended up sitting here at this table is mostly a testament to Johnson. She struggled with her grief for more than a decade, but one day she read a passage from a book about two mothers who had lost sons. The mothers were in heaven.
And one mother said, "I would have taken my child's place on the cross if I could have." And the other mother fell on one knee and she said, "Oh, well, you are she, the mother of Christ." And the mother of Christ lifted her up, kissed a tear from her cheek and said, "Tell me of your son so I may grieve with you." And she said, "My son is Judas Iscariot."
A small seed lodged itself in Mary Johnson's head.
Over the years, I just kept getting this. I'm to do this, two mothers, bring these two mothers together. And I knew that in order to do that, I would have to meet O'Shea.
A caseworker came to me and told me, "Well, hey, Mary Johnson wants to talk with you." You know, I had to really think about it. Like, if my life was taken, I hope the person that took my life would, if they thought they was man enough to take my life, be man enough to face my mom and give her the closure that she needed.
And so early one morning in 2005, Mary Johnson went to the prison in Stillwater, Minnesota, where O'Shea Israel was incarcerated.
Halfway up, I just broke down and I said, "God, I cannot do this. I'm not ready to do this."
But she made it to the conference room and took a seat. Israel says he was ready if Mary Johnson wanted to yell at him or even hit him. But what she said instead surprised him.
I said, "Look, I don't know you. You don't know me. You didn't know my son. My son didn't know you." I said, "We need to lay a foundation. We need to get to know one another." And that's what we did.
They talked about Mary Johnson's son, about her pain, about Israel's remorse. And then they talked about their lives. They talked for 2 hours. Mary Johnson had only planned to visit Israel once. But a moment at the end of the meeting seemed to bind them together when O'Shea Israel asked Mary Johnson if he could hug her.
I felt like, you know, she just offered me her forgiveness. I don't have anything to offer her. At least I can show her some compassion.
They met halfway and embraced.
I tell you, I had something going on in my feet, physically moving, stirring in my feet, and it just moved up and up and up, and I felt this whatever leave me. And I knew that all that hatred and the animosity and the anger, the bitterness, I knew that all that stuff I had inside for 12 years, I just knew it was over. It was over with.
Theirs is not a surprising story in this cafeteria. Each of a dozen tables held families of perpetrators and families of victims, all talking to one another.
Kason Xavier Evans, that was my son's name. His nickname was Biscuit.
Charletta Evans tells her table that 17 years ago, her 3-year-old son was killed in a drive-by shooting by 2 14-year-olds and a 15-year-old. All three got life without parole. Across from her, Mona Schlottman nods her head. Her son was killed by an adult and an accomplice who was a teenager.
I knew he did not get a fair trial, but I didn't care at that time. I was just glad that he had been caught and locked up, and that's as far as I could really care.
It takes a minute before Essa Mathis speaks up. Her son Ralph is serving life without parole.
My son, the seeds of wrong decisions were sown a long time before those decisions were made. Mm. You know, by the time my son was 15 years old, not only did he not have a father, but I had been married and divorced 3 times because of my own brokenness and not knowing how messed up I was. I had to own a part of that.
Everyone in the room wants the teens to pay a price for their crimes, for however many decades in prison. But for every story of trauma victims' families shared, the teens' families seem to describe an equal number of stories of trauma in the perpetrators' lives. Experts have argued that teenagers' brains are less developed than those of adults, so they are more impulsive and less able to weigh the consequences of their actions. But prosecutors say the sentence is an important tool. I spoke with Scott Burns, who is head of the National Association of District Attorneys. He says the sentence is rarely used. 99% of juveniles do get parole. But he says sometimes it's needed.
39 states passed laws, and some of them recently, to provide that in the rarest of cases, life without parole for a juvenile be a possibility. If they were repealing all of these laws, that would likewise show a consensus the other way, but it's not happening in America.
Do you think that someone who commits such a heinous crime at such a young age has the ability to change and express remorse over the decades to come? And do you think that's worth anything?
Well, that's the debate, isn't it? Is it the goal to rehabilitate someone, to see that they change? Or is it also the goal to do justice to the victims and others, and there is some retribution about this for paying for that crime?
But if you ask Mary Johnson, she says for her, rehabilitation is retribution. She says she knows this because she sees it every day in the apartment next to hers. Not long after O'Shea Israel was released from prison, he moved into the apartment next door.
I'm in his business. I get on his case because he won't take my garbage out. You know?
When she's in my business, I really know that she's in my business out of care and concern. She don't want to see me suffer or go through anything that'll cause me any kind of harm or pain. Knowing that I cause her pain, but she's the very person that protects me from it, it's just like, wow.
Mary, you're crying.
Yep, but it's true. He's suffered enough in what he's done, you know. Young people deserve to have a second chance. We all deserve to have a second chance.
Every day, O'Shea Israel stops by to check in on Mary Johnson. They spend their weekends together. Johnson looks across the table at a man, no longer a child, who 2 decades ago killed her 20-year-old boy. To me, she says, O'Shea is like a son. The Supreme Court will rule in the next few months on whether life without parole for teenagers is constitutional. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's already been a big weekend for a particular type of fiction. If you're the parent of a teenager or a soon-to-be teenager, you're likely well aware that The Hunger Games opened in movie theaters across the country this weekend.
And so it was decreed that each year the 12 districts of Pan Am shall offer up in tribute one young man and woman between the ages of 12 and 18 to be trained in the art of survival and to be prepared to fight to the death.
That's Donald Sutherland, the president of a post-apocalyptic country where teenagers are pitted against one another in mortal combat for the viewing pleasure of the populace. And if recent history is any guide, The Hunger Games will be the next huge film franchise to follow a successful series of books targeting a young adult audience. Bob Mondello reviews movies for All Things Considered, and he joins me in the studio. Hello, Bob.
It's good to be here.
First of all, for all of us over 30, give us a brief synopsis of The Hunger Games, and what did you think of it?
Well, I liked it quite a bit. It's basically reality TV on steroids. This is a dystopic North America after the fall of the United States to a terrible war. And the subservient districts of this place are kept subservient by this awful thing they do with the kids, which is to remind them every year of just how subservient they are. And if you're a kid and you're looking at this, it's sort of empowering because the kids are very strong and resist, and the adults don't. So, oh boy, this is the ideal teen picture, right?
Absolutely. Now, I mean, kids went nuts for these books. It's a mm-hmm. hugely popular franchise. I was surprised to learn that this is a fairly recent trend, this young adult lit series just exploding at the box office.
That's fair to say. The big one is
Harry Potter. The boy who lived, come to die.
It made $7.6 billion with a 7-book, 8-movie franchise. Twilight is, I guess, the second biggest, which is about vampires and werewolves.
I, Edward Cullen.
And is a love triangle.
Take you, Bella Swan.
And that one has made over $2 billion. I mean, these are enormously popular.
As long as we both shall live.
And it's never happened in the past, really, largely because the box office mentality has changed. In the 1960s, people started thinking of young adults as somebody different from children. with the James Dean pictures, with The Outsiders. Suddenly, you aimed things at teenagers. And in 1970 or so, you started getting pictures like Jaws and Star Wars and things like that that were real blockbusters. Prior to that, you had hits, right?
Ah.
And you didn't get pictures that were aimed so definitely at family audiences in the summer, for instance, and they didn't click like this.
Would you count Lord of the Rings in that? Or what about Narnia?
Narnia was definitely aimed at kids. I would say that Lord of the Rings is aimed at a slightly older age group. It appeals more broadly. I mean, obviously, it appeals to teenagers, too, but it's not sort of aimed at them in the way that these other pictures are.
I mean, there were a lot of books that were also extremely popular, had large series. Nancy Drew. I grew up reading Nancy Drew.
True, and the Hardy Boys.
And the Hardy Boys.
Right.
Why did we not see huge Nancy Drew Hardy Boys movies?
Well, you didn't see movies, but you saw them on television. And what happened back then was, I mean, Disney, for instance, made a series of the Hardy Boys. My guess is that back in the days when there were only three networks, basically, that those series probably played to enormous audiences by comparison with the ones that are out there today. They might, if they had been in theaters, have made the kind of money that these pictures do now. Hollywood learned its lesson, let's say.
Bob Mondello reviews movies for this program. Bob, always great to see you.
It's always a pleasure.
Every year, thousands of people try to cross the border between Mexico and the United States. If you walk through the desert in southern Arizona, you can find evidence of that trip, the things they leave behind. To some people, it is simply trash to be cleaned up. But to others, it is a window into a perilous voyage. NPR's Lauren Silverman went to the southwest border and has this story.
It's a typical day in Arizona for Jason De Leon. He's lacing up his boots, strapping on his backpack, and heading into the desert.
We'll bring some water, bags in case we need to take some stuff with us, a little bit of food, compass.
Jason is an anthropologist at the University of Michigan, and since 2008, he's spent his summers here, photographing and collecting discarded artifacts for a project. He wants to preserve the objects and possibly return them to the families they belong to.
And you can just kind of make out a blue backpack and maybe a piece of clothing that's laying on the ground.
He rummages through one of the bags.
Let's take a look and see what's inside. Here's some foot powder, matches from Chiapas, some cortisone cream, some cigarettes. There are two black water bottles under that tree.
For him, these scraps are important. This place is important. He says one day it will be seen as an Ellis Island. Off the trail, we spot at least 50 backpacks and as many water bottles scattered among the cacti. A bright green camouflage bag stands out.
Now, why would someone leave a nice backpack like that behind?
You've gotten this far. You're probably fairly dirty. You've sweated a lot. You've been in the desert for a long time. You get picked up. And so what you want to do is try to not look like you've just come through the desert. So you want to get rid of all the stuff that sort of marks you as an undocumented migrant.
Like extra jackets or black plastic sheeting used to make tents in the rain.
We've got some backpacks that are full of some things, so electrolyte bottles, a packet of refried beans that still has beans in them. Typically animals will get to that pretty rapidly, so the fact that there's still food in there tells me that that's pretty recent.
We find caffeine pills migrants take to stay awake and cloves of garlic, Jason explains.
And garlic is often rubbed on clothes as a way to keep away animals. I'm not quite sure if it works, but it definitely is a very common strategy.
Jason reaches into the front pocket of what looks like a high school student's backpack. He pulls out a roll of toilet paper, then...
and a little ring.
He brushes it off with his shirt.
This little tiny ring with a half moon and a star. You know, obviously, I don't think this person wanted to leave this behind.
And what they do leave behind ranges from the sentimental to the ridiculous.
Blow dryer, high heel shoes. A lot of times people either don't know what to expect, so they don't really know how to pack for it, or they want to bring things that are, you know, their favorite things. I found a set of hair curlers once, like with a charger on it.
Jason knows most people don't consider these things sacred. Most people would put them in a garbage bag long before a shelf on any museum.
My name is Melissa Hayes. I'm the project manager for the Arizona Border Trash Project with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality.
Melissa Hayes organizes volunteers to clean up this stuff.
It can affect waterways, pose a risk for wildlife and cattle, pose a threat for potential wildfires, and then also blight to the landscape.
On a recent cleanup, Hayes says volunteers collected around 10,000 pounds of trash north of Nogales, Arizona. It's estimated half of what they bagged was left by migrants.
A group will clean it up, and then you'll see a recurrence of the trash in the same area. Sometimes it'll be in different areas, and a lot of the time, the areas won't even be accessible easily, which poses a challenge as well.
Most of what volunteers collect is typical trash, but sometimes, among the garbage, there are human remains. It's a reminder of just how dangerous this trip is. In the 90s, a few dozen border crossing deaths were reported here every year. But after 2000, that number jumped to an average of a couple hundred deaths, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Tougher border enforcement in states like California pushed migrants east into rougher and more remote areas. And even as the weak economy has led to a decrease in the number of people crossing the border illegally, the rate of border deaths keeps going up. The bodies found in this part of the desert end up here, at the office of the medical examiner in Tucson.
This is our outdoor cooler, what's making the noise in the background.
Gregory Hess, the chief medical examiner in Tucson, is standing in front of a huge refrigerator with racks and sliding shelves filled with body bags.
It holds 142 remains, and 2005 was our first big year for migrant deaths. It was the first year we kind of ran out of space.
So the office doubled storage and hired a full-time forensic anthropologist to handle identifying human remains. Decomposition happens fast in the desert, and that makes getting remains back to the right families tough. The office's forensic anthropologist tries to piece together any bones or artifacts that might help identify the individual. Sometimes they get lucky and find a scrap of paper with a number or even a name. Medical examiner Greg Hess leads me to a small room lined with metal lockers.
This is case 1056 from 2010. It's a John Doe, and there's, you know, some paper with some numbers, some foreign currency, kind of a distinctive little wallet type thing.
When they can't figure out who a person is, the body is cremated and personal items are coded and stored away. Jason De Leon worries those items will be forgotten or even disappear, which is why he comes to this desert every year, rushing to collect what's left. Back in the desert, Jason walks toward a bag that's been bleached white on one side by the sun. Then he stops.
I mean, this is a little tiny shoe. It's a worn-out, sun-dried child's shoe. But, you know, somebody wore this across the desert, and we're far from the border. So someone has gone, has walked a long distance, a very small person.
That little shoe likely belongs to one of the estimated 500,000 migrants who attempted to cross the border here this year. Some make it to the United States, some are deported. Almost all of them leave something behind. Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
New York in the Gilded Age was a city of epic contrast, top-hatted swells and glossy carriages uptown, while just a few blocks south, poverty, crime, and overcrowding were the order of the day. And vice, let's not forget vice. New York was called a wide-open town, with gambling, prostitution, and liquor available on almost every corner. The cops and the Democratic machine politicians of Tammany Hall mostly looked the other way when they weren't actively involved. But in 1895, a new sheriff came to town, literally. Voters throughout the corrupt Democratic administration in favor of reform-minded Republicans, and Theodore Roosevelt was appointed police commissioner. Our book today is Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York. And earlier this week, I met up with author Richard Zacks for a tour of Teddy Roosevelt's old stomping grounds.
All right, so where are we right now?
We're at 300 Mulberry Street.
300 Mulberry,
which
okay.
used to be police headquarters. And
this did? Right here?
This, yeah. I mean, this boring brick apartment building and this garage used to be police headquarters. And Teddy Roosevelt came in here like a hurricane to just clean up all the graft, all the corruption. It was mind-boggling. This was the dirtiest city policemen were taking bribes to do. It let you do almost anything. And Roosevelt, in hindsight, what he was trying to do, it's like somebody going into Vegas and just saying, there's going to be no more gambling.
Zacks leads me on a ramble around the Lower East Side, once one of the toughest neighborhoods in New York.
Delancey Street is, especially among Jewish people, is revered as, you know, Delancey Street, Lower East Side, push carts, all the rest of it. Well, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16 Delancey Street were all brothels. So anyhow, I'm walking along here, and I'm just kind of looking for, because I know 6, 8, 10, and 12 are going to be former brothels. And what do I come on? The Bowery Ballroom, which is a club that you know has lots of performances. But at some point, this location was a brothel and the One Mile House next door as well.
And so it turns out it's still a bar
today. It's still in the entertainment business.
It's still in the entertainment.
And there were 150 more brothels within a mile of the street corner we're standing on. He leads me farther east on Delancey to the former site of a uniquely New York institution, a Raines Law Hotel. You see, liquor sales were illegal on Sundays, a fact that the cops ignored. Teddy Roosevelt decided he was going to change that. He was going to enforce all the laws, even if they were unpopular. His Dry Sunday campaign earned him the ire of almost everyone in the city. But it was reasonably successful at first, until the state legislature decided to get involved.
John Raines, state senator, comes forward and decides he's going to give Roosevelt even more ammunition to shut down the saloons on Sunday. He's going to pass a law that includes the fact that the saloons must be, their front doors must be locked, side doors locked as well, and their curtains open so the police could look in and see whether the bars were operating on Sundays. And it also had a clause that said hotels, if they had 10 bedrooms or more, could serve liquor 24/7 with a meal. And at first, when it passed April, when it went into effect April 1st, 1896, New York thought it was going to become just dead dry on Sundays. People were appalled. The headlines all said that. And then about a week later, all more than 1,000 saloon keepers began converting their saloons to hotels, to Raines Law hotels. And no one knew if it would work. They just started converting. One guy converted an attic, and he said that only a midget could stand up in one of my 10 rooms. You know?
So they made 10 little closets upstairs.
Right. One guy used a coal bin. They made 10 little closets. But you know who the building inspectors were? They were Tammany Hall guys. And they wanted to let everybody drink and have a good time. So they okayed these 10 rooms. And not only could they serve on Sundays, they could serve all night long. New York really became the city that never sleeps because you had over 1,000 Raines Law hotels open all night long.
All night long.
Amazing.
Were they actually selling food?
Oh, that's the funny part. They Eugene O'Neill wrote in one of his plays about seeing a mummified ham and cheese sandwich. Nobody wanted to eat the sandwiches. And there were like all these jokes about that sort of thing. One bartender yells to the owner, "We got to stop serving." Owner says, "Why? Do we run out of beer?" The bartender says, "No, some yokel ate the sandwich. There's not another one on the whole east side."
As nasty as that sandwich sounds, Raines Law hotels were almost respectable compared to other New York drinking establishments.
39 Mulberry was one of the stale beer dives, one of the really raunchiest, most derelict, bottom of the food chain joints to go have a drink.
They called them stale beer dives.
Yeah, the stuff was the leavings of the bars around the rest of the city. The guys would go and beg the leftover, buy the leftover stuff. Literally, they'd wipe the bar down and then have the rag, wring out the rag into a bucket, and that would be the kind of swill that they were selling for like a penny a can. And this was one of the most derelict parts of the city. This was Fowl Valley's stale beer dive.
So what were the cops doing when all this was going on? Part of the answer lies here on Eldridge Street, one of the most notorious streets on the Lower East Side.
They had a police precinct house at 107 Eldridge, and that's where Captain Big Bill Devery, who was notorious for see, hear, say nothing, eat, drink, pay nothing. He was the one of the most corrupt cops in New York City history. He winds up becoming chief of police.
And, he became the chief of police.
Yeah. He's indicted 4 times, beats the rap 4 times, becomes the chief of police.
Well, that worked out pretty well for him, then.
And it worked out even better. He co-founded the New York Yankees. True story.
When Teddy Roosevelt first went after corrupt cops like Big Bill Devery, Roosevelt was enormously popular. But back in the studio, Zax tells me that Roosevelt's inability to bend on enforcing even the most minor laws eventually did him in.
It played much better outside the city than inside the city. But he tried so hard. This city was so corrupt. And the idea of a man standing up and trying to enforce the law against drinking in saloons on Sundays, it's mind-boggling. Or the law against all the little petty briberies that went on that the police shook down boot blacks and pushcart guys and all that. Roosevelt wanted an absolutely clean city, and this was Sodom. And Roosevelt didn't back down.
Why would he push so hard for something that was so unpopular? I mean, he was doing so well. And then he went for the one thing. It seems like from your book that most people wanted to get rid of some of the corruption, but he started targeting the thing that they enjoyed the most.
He did. I think Roosevelt didn't see any gray areas. He saw black and white. And this was illegal. It was conspicuous. Everyone knew about it. And he went after it. And there's another reason that could come into play, although Roosevelt didn't bring up this reason. But his brother had died of alcohol-related causes 8 or 9 months earlier. So it was fresh in his mind. When he went to his brother's house after his brother died, there were dozens of empty liquor bottles in the rooms. So Roosevelt had been personally hurt by this experience.
Was he always so inflexible?
I limited myself to 1895 to 1897. He was very rigid during that period. When he got an idea, he stuck with it. And he admitted a little regret to his sister in a private note. He said he hit an ugly snag, the Sunday Saloon Law, and he said that he had harmed the saloon owner he didn't mind harming, but also some good people, for which I am sorry. But New Yorkers would never hear the word sorry from Roosevelt's mouth.
What was the impact of those 2 years of slogging it out, day in and day out, fighting with everybody, pushing so hard? Did it have any sort of lasting impact?
I think the lasting impact was more for Roosevelt, frankly, than for the city. The lasting impact for Roosevelt was he learned to make speeches, more aggressive speeches. He learned to handle an audience. He learned to handle criticism. He found himself on the front page of newspapers, and he had to deal with it. He also achieved a national reputation as a law and order reform Republican, and it worked very well for him.
That's Richard Zaks. He's the author of Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Doomed Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
When Canadian-born R&B singer Melanie Fiona made her debut album, The Bridge, in 2009, she made it a point to do no collaborations, even though they were the ticket to increased record sales. Some people told her it was a risk, but the risk paid off. Her single, It Kills Me, became her breakout song, sending her to the Billboard Hot 100 for 10 weeks. Now, after winning 2 Grammys, Melanie Fiona is all about collaborations. Her new album, The MF Life, features songs with J. Cole, John Legend, and Nas. Even with the release of her new album this week, Fiona is still reeling from her Grammy wins.
It feels like what it should feel in the definition of dreams come true, if that makes sense. It's an amazing feeling, and this particular award is such a humbling experience. And, you know, to know that I've made music history and the Academy recognizes me forever, I'll be a 2-time Grammy Award-winning artist, if nothing else, it's an amazing feeling. I'll probably stay on cloud 9 for as long as I can.
When you got up for your acceptance speech, you got up to the microphone and you said, "Hi, everyone, I'm Melanie Fiona."
What a goof.
Why did you feel like you had to introduce yourself?
Because I felt like I was meeting the world for the first time.
Right.
I know when I look back at that, I laugh. I crack up because I say, "What? You're so goofy." And you come up there in this like gown and makeup and everybody's expecting this, you know, this very serious. And I come up there goofy. "Hi, everyone. I'm Melanie Fiona. And it is nice to meet all of you." Because that's how I felt. You know, I've been attending the Grammys for the last 3 years and, you know, have been nominated and never won. And just, you know, I just felt like, wow, I'm finally meeting everybody for the first time.
Tell me about the title of this album, The MF Life. I mean, I have to say, we sat around trying to figure out if this is the MF as in Melanie Fiona, or if you're saying, of course, the obvious other.
Wow.
So here you are.
Let's get the obvious.
Let's get the scoop.
That's perfect. It's actually doing exactly what it's supposed to. It's supposed to make you think. Hmm. And it's really up for interpretation. Some people automatically are like, "Oh, yeah, her initials are MF. It's Melanie Fiona." And then some people are like, "MF is magnificent, fantastic," or other all puns ruder intended. Mm-hmm. It's all perception, which is what I want this album to be. I wanted it to be a collection of music and songs that make people think about the things that we actually go through and feel and to acknowledge that.
Well, let's listen to one of the tracks from the album. This is a single that's getting a lot of airplay right now. Here's 4 a.m. I don't think my baby is calling somebody else, baby. And I can't sit still. Look how gone it got me. Harder than my heart could ever bruise. You see this scar here on my chest. I'm hurting, and he don't even care. It's pouring him and my lover won't answer. That's Melanie Fiona with the track 4 a.m. off her new album. Some of the men that come up in some of the lyrics in the song, they're not, how should I put this? They're not quality. I mean, are you getting even maybe a little bit?
No, you know, the thing is that it's actually not that they're not quality. They're actually just human. And not everybody is right for you, right? That's why you generally maybe find love once in your lifetime. Or you get married once in your lifetime, or three times if you're lucky. Who knows? Whatever your perception is. But it's just about acknowledging what every situation is about, you know? For example, in the album, there's a song called Running, you know, speaking about being tired of working on a love. Shouldn't have to cry for you to make me smile. Hey, talking down to me like I'm your child. Oh. He's not necessarily a bad guy, but maybe he's just not right for me or right for you. And that's just the reality of it. You know, not everybody is going to be Prince Charming.
I'm speaking with Grammy Award-winning R&B singer Melanie Fiona, and her new album is called The MF Life. I want to listen to another track from the album right now, which is Watch Me Work.
Yes. Out the box, out the blue. Watch me work. Something sexy, something fine. Watch me work. Out the box, blow your mind.
This song, Watch Me Work, is so different than the others. I mean, it's almost rock and roll.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
It's rock and soul. You know, it comes from my background, my love of just music. You know, in the first album, if you listen to The Bridge, I had Bang Bang on there, which was rock and soul. It was my Tina Turner, and it's my moment to really let loose on stage and to be able to have that kind of aggression and attitude and sass. It is definitely a side of me, and I needed to have that on this album, and Watch Me Work is that. And in keeping in the theme of the ups and downs of love, that song is about stepping out of the shadows and being unapologetic for who you are and, you know, putting the spotlight on yourself and having people pay attention to you. There's nothing wrong with that, you know, owning who you are.
Well, speaking of that spotlight, I mean, you've written a lot of songs for Rihanna, who's getting a lot of heat right now for doing two new collaborations with Chris Brown. We know a little bit about their story with the physical abuse and the restraining orders and so on. And now you're stepping up into that limelight and becoming famous. Do you feel that pressure to be a role model, to have to represent for young girls?
You know, I definitely do. I take what I do very seriously, and I consider myself to be a responsible person in general, not just because I'm in the public eye. But, you know, it's one thing when it's just you having to reflect on yourself, but it's another thing when you have the world reflecting and commenting. So, you know, I take it very seriously. I do give myself a break because I am human and I'm not perfect. And there are going to be things that I'm going to have to go through publicly that, you know, are going to be difficult for me. But I feel like as long as my integrity and my heart, I think, is in the right place, and I keep that integrity honest with my fans, that, you know, anything I might need a pass for or forgiveness for or, you know, a second chance for, I think is what people, I think, are okay with. I think they just need to feel like you mean it and you're honest about what's happening to you.
Mm. You did a lot of collaborations on The MF Life, Nas, John Legend, and here's the song This Time, which you did with J. Cole.
Yeah.
You
can't rewrite the past. All I can do is sing. This time, I'm doing much better. Love you like I never loved you before. Oh, baby, this time, I'm giving my heart and soul in every drop of my love.
both hot. I guess we couldn't take the jealousy.
That's the song This Time with J. Cole. Is this the way we're going with selling records? Is this, you got to do collaborations if you want to, do you want to get your records off the shelf?
I think there is a, there's two sides to that, you know. I think it's all selective. On my first album, I made the conscious decision to have zero features. I wanted it to be about me and my art and, you know, people to digest who I am there. Now, my mode of collaboration on and off this album and with all the artists, Nas and J. Cole, B.O.B., these are just artists that I actually respect and I love and want to work with and want their energy on my songs. When the girl of his dreams is the same when they wake him up. This time.
So much of this album seems to be about learning from mistakes. Is that how you see it?
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Too often people focus on the sadness of some of the records, and that's not what it is. And I hope that the people listening get that I am not a downtrodden, sad, negative person or woman. I'm very strong. I consider myself to be a very strong woman because I acknowledge the things that I've been through. I'm not afraid to speak about them. I'm not afraid to go through the range of emotions that it is to deal with them and to be better for it so that I don't make the same mistakes twice. That's the point of life, I think. You know, if when you start doing the same things over and over and again and you're expecting a different outcome, that's insanity. I say these things and I sing about these things because I have learned so much about myself through my highs and my lows. And I think that that's what I hope people are inspired to do when they hear my story and hear their story through my album.
That's two-time Grammy winner Melanie Fiona, and she spoke with me from our studios in New York. Her new album, The MF Life, is out now. Thanks so much, Melanie, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's sad that memories never die. Just fill your head with wine, then you're caught living a lie again. It's sad that all he ever said was that he loved me to death, but then he's gone again, and I was wrong again. Never coming back. Should've known the long kiss goodbye would bring sadness in my life. Wearing this disguise again, I wish that you would've said or lied to me instead. Like a bullet to my head, like a fool, I pretend that it's on again.
You're gone and never coming back.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Petra Mayer and Kenya Young. It is produced by Phil Harrell with the assistance of Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Amy Held. Mathani Mukturi is the senior editor, and Steve Lichtig is the senior producer. I'm Laura Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.
Coming back. Oh, he's not coming back.